You're listening to 94 and More, where we explore how basketball can challenge us to reimagine our world in new and unexpected ways. I'm Luke Tadashi, the founder of Bristol Studio. Today's episode is actually the second part of our conversation with Professor David Hollander. If you have not had a chance to listen to part one, we highly recommend you check that out first. The topics of this conversation build on what we discussed in our previous episode. That being said, if you just want to dive straight in on part two, go ahead. Hope you all enjoy. I thought it was really kind of a sweet anecdote in your story where you talk about how, like really up until the 80s, I think when China like opened, it started to open its doors, like they thought basketball was created in China. Like they thought it was theirs.
Yeah.
And I think it just speaks to that idea of like, nobody owns the game. You know, we all come to it at our own time, but the connection is real for all of us.
Yeah. It's, guys in the Philippines are playing with their own feeling around this game. It's amazing what happens when you don't ascribe ownership or nationality to this game, how much fun people have.
Yeah, and I think that's a great segue to start our conversation a little bit about pickup basketball, because I think that in the way you're talking about basketball and in the way that I see it, is like pickup basketball is the purest form of the sport. And you tie pickup basketball to so many of these larger themes in your book. I love this concept of open democracy, open run. I love how you tie basketball to immigration, pickup basketball in Canada, and you talk about that. So, you know, and then you talk about, you know, women in Somalia and how pickup basketball does things for them. And I don't want to give too much away, but those are just a few of the things that I think it would be awesome to hear you talk about.
Thank you. I believe that one of the frustrations of many people in society is that they feel like they're living without dignity. They feel like they're not allowed to ever feel that greatness that they see others having on television and things like that. And I want to see a society that gives people the ability to feel the pride, feel the ownership, feel like they are stakeholders in whatever the society is trying to do that's great and good, which makes them feel better about everything, their children, their partners, their family, their neighbor. And that requires removing barriers to access. If there's anything good that a society wants to be, then that thing that is good must be able to be had. I don't see that happening in all kinds of really important places like education, healthcare, wealth creation. And so I believe that one of the things that basketball stands for is that there should be no barrier to access. And one of the great manifestations of that principle is pickup basketball. Now, other sports play pickup too, but I don't know if I've ever found any other sport that gives so many people the ability to instantly, because of the space, because of the how little you need, the ability to, without verbal language, connect, belong, engage, access something. Nobody checks your ID. Nobody asks for your citizenship. Nobody wants to know your resume, your background, anything. Nobody organizes it except those that are there themselves. Everybody seems to agree that there are certain ways we'll go about this. There's an honor that's you call your own fouls, you know, winner stays on, whatever the local customary rules are. It's an honor that, I mean, far to me surpasses the honor of the tennis club or the golf club, except everyone here can play. Anybody can show up and play. The social contract is extraordinary. And because of that, in all these different societies that have strata, that have caste, that have whatever their overtime or recently imposed structures of access or non-access are, the basketball court, the free and open public basketball court, unlike anything I have ever seen anywhere else on earth, gives a chance for somebody who's not feeling that, hasn't been given the avenue over time, over generations, because of discrimination, because of hate. It gives them a space to demonstrate belonging, to feel the power of ownership, to enjoy the space of creativity and entrepreneurship, to connect with others who may or may not be like them, but for that moment are engaged together. Am I talking about basketball, or am I talking about a way for society to like heal? I find the model pretty pure in pickup basketball for a better democracy, a better sharing, a better sense of, oh, you're like me, or you're not so different from me, or a dissolution of the you and me, and it's just us.
Yeah. So now there's a couple things from that I want to root this idea in. And I mentioned them off the top, but I think that that's a great bird's eye view of it. And I think that this idea of dignity is really important. And I think you're absolutely right. Like, we all just want to feel a sense of dignity. And I think that's harder and harder to come by in our world today. And I think dignity means a few things, but I think one of the things that it really means is my life matters, and that I matter, and that I'm connected to something greater than myself. And I love this story you tell in your book about these young women in Somalia, and how, you know, Somalia is this, for many reasons, this really oppressive culture for women. And quite literally, their lives are in danger in many, many ways on a daily basis. And they're prevented from playing basketball in a lot of cases because, you know, the men in charge see the connection between basketball and freedom, and
they see it.
They don't want that. But you say, I'm going to read you this quote that you say, because I think it exemplifies the power of pickup basketball. So you're talking about these young women in Somalia who love the game, and you say, they get that being, I think you mean dignity, but they get that from just doing the thing they love, basketball. They love it because it lets them love themselves, which means they're here on earth included. It ties directly to the special power of the game to be an expression of inclusion and equity for women. And that "for women" part could be for anybody, but talk about that a little bit.
This game is really amazing. Once, you know, and it's so interesting, right? That in Somalia, there is an extremist faction, violent extremist faction, Al-Shabaab, who, yes, they have some very restrictive ideas about what women can be in society. And they, in particular, focused on basketball playing. They said, and especially if you play basketball. they know. Any oppressive regime knows that basketball is a place where once people taste it, once people taste that experience of a body in freedom, in ownership, in community, there's no going back. And for the women of Somalia, of Mogadishu, they're willing to risk their lives, their families, their futures, just so they can say, I am here and I'm not going anywhere, even if it's my life is in danger, even this means my life will end at the end of this. I mean, extraordinary courage. It's like in Iran right now, where at some point, if you remove the thing from your face, you remove the
hijab,
the prohibition, yeah, the hijab, you say, I can't be any other way anymore. And it's an extraordinarily powerful thing. So I take that example as like as a really extreme example. It's true that these women in Somalia, Mogadishu, in Africa, have been for the past 15 years, 20 years, have been this oasis of social progress, which has led to, in the book, I talk about the Elman Center, which has become the haven for violence against women, for all kinds of social freedoms for citizens. And basketball is the tool. Basketball is the space that they come to show how you can feel this way. That's why Masai Ujiri showed up, and it's just I built a thesis years ago asking myself, why does basketball make me feel this way? And I began to find these stories, which are remarkable and totally consistent with what the game was intended to do. And I think it's now doing it in a place like Mogadishu for women risking their lives in a way that I don't think anybody, Naismith, anybody could have thought would have been so powerful and important.
Yeah, man. I think too, in our world, in the West, I guess it's just as powerful in different ways, and maybe the stakes aren't as high as they are for young women in Somalia. But earlier in our conversation, you talked about this theme of consolidation, and I think that's a big thing when I look around in our world that I notice is consolidation. Whether that's, I think really in terms of like wealth consolidation, right? It's like only in certain circles now does that control live there? And if you're outside of that circle, you don't have access to that. And I think that in our world, and you talked a little bit about this, but the pickup basketball court is where maybe one of the last places in our society where people do come together, and it doesn't, it not only doesn't matter, whether you're rich, poor, white, black, male, female, it actually only matters if you can be with other people and play well. And I think in a world that's more and more consolidated, we need more and more of these spaces that break apart those consolidations. So
you really, I went to see True West. It's a Sam Shepard play, and there was a talk back afterwards, and they talked about, wow, Sam Shepard's plays always end in like these just like violent melees at the end of the play, and there's always violent seething throughout the play. And what was explained was that, well, Shepard felt in America violence, and it's become a violent place, according to Shepherd, is the result of people just feeling their inadequacy in the society. And you feel that inadequacy when you feel like you're not hitting the goal, you're not measuring up. And, you know, in the book, I talk about Draymond Green. Draymond Green, who statistics night after night are weird and uneven and hard to kind of, you wouldn't put him on any all-star team based on those statistics, those metrics people like to call in business. But everybody on the court knows what Draymond Green means to that team. And everybody on the court knows Steph Curry, the glittering star, knows that without Draymond Green, there is no championship. A society like a team in basketball that values what Draymond Green does in the same way that they value what Steph Curry does, to me, is a basketballistic society, which means it bestows that dignity. It removes those feelings of inadequacy in a society that says the only people that really matter are the CEO, are the, you know, the tech entrepreneur, are the zillionaire, the you know, the 3 million views influencer. This is what creates the recurring problem.
If our society today was an NBA team, which team would we be?
Well, I'm sorry to say the Brooklyn Nets, who are the just become the caricature of, of a team full of, on one level, a remarkable, measurable talent. And on another level, they're just not playing the game. They're not, and as an organization, so, you know, the NBA is a business. They are an unfortunate reflection of our worst kind of directions and impulses at the moment.
And what team present?
I love past? You. I love you, KD. I do. You know that.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like individually, there's so many incredible pieces, but collectively, the human alchemy isn't there. They don't become something greater.
Yeah. They don't. And of course, there's just kind of, you know, just certain odd behaviors, over time. And I would even also just step back and say the idea for the process, that I think also was quite a reflection of our times, where there was kind of a warped idea that to win, we must lose.
That's interesting. That could be a whole podcast unto itself.
Yes, it certainly could. A lot of people have strong opinions on it, and I don't want to go to Philadelphia and get beat up by half the Sixers fans. Love that team. Love them.
They take their sports seriously over there.
Yeah. I ran into this idea called Open Democracy through an Ezra Klein podcast, and I started reading more about it. And the idea is that democracy is a big word, and it can be exercised through different kinds of structures. We are currently in a representative democracy, as we all know, right? We don't, everybody in the country doesn't vote on every single thing. We vote for representatives, and they vote on every single thing. The idea of open democracy is that representative democracy is no longer working in this society because of well, all kinds of different factors over time, money, what our society is valuing. But basically, what you see is the people who represent us no longer really represent us, meaning they don't look like us or don't speak for us. They're mostly male, white, charismatic, good-looking, you know, wealthy. And although, you know, some of us may look like that, most of us don't, and most of us aren't. And the idea is that really the way we find the truthful expression of something we can all live with is by having something more akin to a jury system where we draft lots of people to come to debate, argue, communicate about how we should legislate, how we should govern. And that would be a truer expression of who we all are. Open democracy, not representative democracy. And that's a truncated explanation, but I love it because I think it's correct. I think we are in a society that can no longer kind of find a true elected representation of the what most people look like, sound like, feel like. And so when you look at a pickup game, other than the drafting part, the jury selection part, you see kind of a similar thing. You see a kind of a random thrown together of people who show up for open run meaning a public, you know, anybody can show up and play basketball here tonight, this afternoon, whether it's an indoor gym or outdoor. And I think when you attend that, you begin to see the roots of a more equitable society. You see the roots of, I don't know you, you don't know me, I didn't choose you, you didn't choose me, but we are thrown together and forced to figure shit out together. And that's open run, which I think tells us a lot about how open democracy can work. Because like I say in the book, and I like to use this example a lot, I've been to a lot of open runs, you have too. And I've played with complete strangers where we've been forced to kind of be family in a very short period of time. And I can leave open run and still not know the name of that person, not know where they're from, where they live, or anything. But we may just see each other on the street, I say, in a deli or a laundromat or a bookstore or wherever. And we see each other, and across the distance, we'll give each other that nod, that acknowledgement. In other words, we are connected, and we know what we can do together. And this is cool. You're cool. I'm cool. I trust you. I know what you're capable of. You know what I'm capable of. You know what I'm willing to do. I know what you're willing to do. We're not having those conversations, those connections in the overwhelming majority of time in our lives. We're having a very different kind of experience. We're mostly railing against lots of things and feeling powerless. I think open democracy like open run like open democracy gives us a glimpse of what happens when we're all empowered, even if we don't know each other.
Yeah.
Lots of great things can happen.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I think that one of the things is it encourages more participation, which is huge. And we need that because right now it feels like the participants who affect our democracy are overwhelmingly people of great wealth. And if you don't have great wealth, it feels like you're more and more hopeless to impact.
And the wealth and the white and the male, I mean, I'll withhold judgment whether, you know, person by person, they're good, bad. That's not the point. The point is representation and participation, that we all feel like we get to say something and somehow it translates into the society that we want and are living in, and a way we can get along with others in that society.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I thought that concept was fascinating, and connecting just Open Run and Open Democracy was very surprising and delightful. So I'm excited for people to read that in your book. But I think too, what this reminds me of a little bit is what, in general, on an academic level, and I guess professional level too, you are doing with basketball particularly, but sports in general, basketball particularly, is you are legitimizing this idea of sport as an academic discipline. And I think it would be cool to hear you talk about it, and it ties into your book a little bit, but
thanks Charles Barkley for that quote. So I'm a professor in a university in academia, and I take it very seriously. I love what I do. I love teaching. I love helping young people develop and find their joy and empower them to go on and excel in life. And I believe that the responsibility of the academy, which is the responsibility that filters down to every single one of us on the faculty and the student affairs, the responsibility is for us to produce people from our work who make the world a better place. That's our socially responsible, no matter if it's the business school or they're studying English, that's the idea. To create, I think, productive citizens that make the world a better place. And I don't understand why this thing called athletics is separate from that endeavor. It makes no sense to me. And I'll analogize to other similar things that you can, that the academy does honor. You can get a degree in art. In other words, you can make art, and that can be a substantial part of you getting an academic degree. You can get a degree in music. You can learn how to make music, dance, acting, all kinds of wonderful things, where the doing of it is the learning. And there's a lot around that learning, I know, which says when you do this art, when you do this acting, when you do this kind of thing, there's a great deal you learn about society and humanity. I agree. It's the same thing with athletics. I believe that the doing of it, when you play tennis, when you play football, basketball, you're learning about how to be with others. You're learning about how to solve problems. You're learning all kinds of skills that open the door, give you a lens to begin to solve other problems in society, to understand other types of human conflict and relationships. And I think it's high time that we move athletics over to that side of the house. It's weird that there's an athletic department And let's just put big time Division One major conference men's basketball and football to the side for a moment. Okay, these revenue generating sports, but just D3, right? It is just an odd thing to me that they sit with another building, another staff, with so much time and energy devoted to it. And it's said that this, you know, enhances the academic experience. How? If it does, then why isn't it just academic, period? It ought to be. It's okay. There's a famous Ernst & Young study, EY study, about women who've played college athletics. There's something like 50 to, I forget what the, I think it's a minimum of 50%. I think it's a higher number. 50% of C-suite women have played college athletics. There might be something to that. And I believe there is something to that. I believe that someone should be teaching you what this thing means that you're doing, that you're spending so much time on. And my course is one example. There are other people who teach other courses that do the same thing. My point is that we can academize athletics in a way that's much more efficient, that brings it in line with what the university is supposed to be doing. And so, yeah, that's what I think.
No, I think that it's huge. And I think that it's exactly right. As somebody who's grown up loving and playing sports, I think some of my greatest moments of self-realization and learning have taken place outside of that classroom and on that court. So I think it's about time we need people to catch up with that. Yeah. And I feel like what you're doing is leading to that. But
well, I hope so. You know, I teach sports business, which is a morally conflicted place for me, putting those two words together. But I gotta believe that there's more to the cultural form known as sports and athletics than just the hyper-commercialization of it. There's got to be more to do with it than just that. And I think we've tilted just so far in the direction of nothing but the only reason you do sports is to get a scholarship, make a lot of money. There's some, you know, it's outcome-based.
I think also, and we'll get into this actually with some of our guests in this season, but I think that sports is just one of the greatest platforms for trying, failing, succeeding, failing, you know. And I feel like it's a teacher of resiliency in a way that just about nothing else is. And if I look around, just, you know, and I take what this conversation today with you has been, is there's so much feeling of not belonging, dislocation, my place in this, all of that. And seems like one of the most important skills in today's world is resiliency, just the ability to keep going, to you know, see a brighter outcome at a certain point. And sports does that in a way that few things do, and it grounds it in it's not some hocus pocus. It's like it really shows that you have to work at it, but if you do enough work, if there's enough rigor of thought, you will get to a better place.
Yeah. Anybody who's played sports, given effort, knows that is so true. And it makes you believe that you can get through other challenges because you've tried and failed and then kind of overcome and tried and failed and overcome again. And it teaches so much about the human condition, which is what all the things we study that's what we're trying to understand, the human condition, whether it's literature or philosophy or sociology or economics. This thing called athletics, it's a powerful, extraordinary, wide-ranging teacher of the human condition, like art, like music, like drama, which are also just, you know, make tremendous contributions to our understanding of who we are and what we can be.
Yeah, and I think too, one of the most, many impressive things, but one of the more impressive things that you've done through your course that I think, if nothing else, helps legitimize the study of sport would be what you and your students did around the patron saint of basketball. And I would love for you to share that story because there's a lot of listeners that I know aren't familiar with it. So tell us about that.
Oh my goodness. I will tell you a story. So around Christmas time last year, 2021, I was reading an article in the New York Times about a little village in central Italy in that village, there's a church. And in that church, there's a shrine to basketball. And people come from all over the country to pray at that shrine. They pray for a better jump shot, a better season, a healed meniscus. And this church, which has been around since the 15th century, there's a bridge that connects it to the village of Peretta Terme. And on that village, there's a likeness of Madonna. They call her the Madonna del Ponte, the Madonna of the Bridge. And I read in this article that the village had made petition to the Vatican to have the Madonna del Ponte, their local Madonna, be recognized as the first ever patron saint of basketball. So I called my TA from the year before, who is Italian. He had graduated. He's working in New York City. I'm like, hey, man, did you read this? He's like, yeah, I did. It's incredible. I'm like, yeah. He's like, well, I'm home for the holidays in Bologna, which was driving distance to the church. He drove to the church. He grabbed the priest. The priest, the first guest, first class, first hour of How Basketball Saved the World, spring 2022. And I asked him, I said, Father, what can I do? How can I help this cause? It's amazing. He said, I don't know. You know, I said, well, class, 157 students. I said, class, this isn't for a grade. I said, but everybody send me one sentence tomorrow. Why does basketball deserve its own saint? And they did, and I compiled it in a letter, and it was like a listing, like the Magna Carta, Declaration of Independence, you know, because basketball is a universal language, because basketball, like, you know, makes us communicate, because basketball, all these things. And I put it in a beautiful letter, and I sent it to Cardinal Zuppi, who was carrying the Cardinal Bologna, carrying the petition to the Pope. And somehow Italian media got a hold of it. Italian media, major media, La Repubblica, which is like the Washington Post of Italy, and they printed the letter in full in this feature article saying this is the first international gesture of support, this NYU professor and his students, for this stalled petition. This could be it. That was March of 2022. On April 12th, Good Friday, the Pope recognize the first ever patron saint of basketball.
It's incredible.
It's true. It really is incredible.
I love when I tell people there's a patron saint of basketball, their jaw just drops because it's, you know, I don't know. It's impressive.
I'm blown away by it. And as you know, I was accompanied by your team when we went to that village this summer, and there really was something magical about the people, the town, the whole idea of it. I mean, officials came from all over the country, Milan, Venice, Rome, to celebrate that moment. And it's the first ever team sport to be given a patron saint. Why is that? Why did the Pope say, oh, this one, not soccer, which is really the sport of that country and most of Western Europe. He believes that there's something about the game. You had quoted him earlier about it makes you look up. It somehow has been a force for healing. It somehow was a force. He had pointed to it during the the protests, the marches, George Floyd, which went out all over the world, and he saw basketball as such an important force for teaching people how to overcome the obstacles that are still plaguing us, still dividing us. This is what the Pope said. I think it's just the beginning of, we got a little something in store for the UN this semester. And I see this, many people are familiar with Peace Players International, highly decorated organization that uses basketball in the highest conflict spots on earth to help evolve, not conflict resolution. They don't call conflict evolution. And it works. And I, to the extent that I can like add anything to the notion anywhere in the world that basketball can just make us 5% better, 10% better, open our eyes to the potential of what we can be with each other, man, then I will have done something for my daughter, who I hope enters a world that's just a little bit better than the one that I entered.
Yeah. And I mean, I think I this is maybe the dreamer in me, but I think that's why your work really, really speaks to me, is because there's this sense that it is about getting 5%, 10% better, and we all have to believe we're here for a reason, and if what better reason than the time that I've been given here. Maybe can make this place slightly better, and I don't know. It just it's really.
And I'll tell you, Luke. And yeah, that's I do believe that's what all of us in our best selves want. And I think what's motivated me, and what resonates perhaps with others in the work that I've done, is that we got to try something. Like something new has to come forward. We can't go on like this. I'm not despairing. I'm not cowering in the corner. And I'm not whining. I'm saying that this is it. This is our chance to kind of look at other things. We're strong enough to do it. We can get new language. We can look to new sources of thinking and ideas in human relationships. And though it may sound like silly to some, basketball, really? Try it. Try being in that mix. And then you'll know what I know. What Luke knows, what others know, what hundreds of students have now come to this class and they're like, yeah, just tell me how it works, because I feel it. I feel it. I've always felt it. And, I can't get trapped in any more of these conversations that keep leading us to division. I can't get trapped anymore in these television shows that are so narrow in their explanation. I can no longer kind of accept these either or propositions. I want to go somewhere else. Which doesn't mean anarchy. It doesn't mean chaos. It means, I think the next time, like, the whole world gets hit by a pandemic, we could do a little better.
Yeah.
We could do a little better, you know? Yeah. And if we're going to just go back, I'm here to raise my hand and say, how about we try something else?
Yeah. I can't help but think that if we collectively made it a priority to build some more courts around the world, that it would be cool if someone did a study to kind of see, just because I think that, you know, that's how our world works, is we need evidence. But I think that there's a really great study to be had out there to correlate more basketball courts with better social outcomes. And I think it's just waiting for someone to do it. So I don't know. Maybe that should be one of the next the next initiatives in the class.
I love that, by the way. I think that is the concrete, literally, next thing that needs to be done. You know, our friend Dan Peterson with Project Backboard has been a leader in this area, and there are other folks. I mean, that's why you hear Masai Ujiri wants to build 100 courts across the continent of Africa. That's why it's a big part of Steph Curry and Kevin Durant's, you know, kind of philanthropic efforts. There are other groups. It seems to be the consensus answer. And again, it sounds people like, really? That's what you're going to do? Build more basketball courts? Go check out these courts that have been renewed, which have renewed communities. It works.
And I think too, it was, it might've been Peace Players International. It was somebody, but that was building basketball courts in high conflict zones. And I remember, as I have this quote in front of me that Brendan Toohey said, of Peace Players International. And he said, we're not saying that, hey, the active playing of basketball together is going to on its own be the answer, but it creates the foundation. It creates that, quote, all right, I can see you, I can relate to you. Now, can we look to maybe have a deeper conversation or form a friendship? And I do think there's something there. I think
at a minimum, the idea that we need to find vehicles to humanize each other. I think basketball is as good a one as I've ever come across, but we need to be together. We need to see each other in the room. We do. It's where we must get back to. Not meta.
Yeah.
Like actual.
And it feels too to me like the tools that we now have access to, and I think about going back to as early as, you know, like the 40s when atomic weapons kind of came to be. And then now you look at today and, you know, people are talking about AI and, you know, these more like existential, potentially existential threats. And I think it's gonna require a, like, almost evolutionary leap in how we think and relate to one another.
Yeah.
And I think that to wrap it up, I think that speaks to your last principle, transcendence. But we need to transcend whatever this is where we are today in order to meet the challenges of the 21st century and beyond.
We do. And I hope when people see my book and they see these 13 principles, they understand that, like you've just said, these are guiding principles. This is my 10 commandments. This is my Bhagavad Gita. This is my, like, if you get lost with what you're doing, ask yourself, is it in service of these principles? So this is not a principle. It's not like no AI or no, you know, virtual this or digital this. It's to say that these tools, magnificent tools, need to be in service of these principles. That's all. And that's an exciting future. That's an exciting future. Future grounded in basketballistic principles.
Absolutely.
I say.
Yeah.
And I hope I make a compelling argument in the book, and you've been very kind to let me explain.
No, of course. Well, let's get you bigger and bigger platforms to spread the word and the message. And I think, I think it's going to resonate. Thank you.